Welcome to the Caribbean Property Investing Podcast, where we share real-life experiences for successful Caribbean property entrepreneurs. Learn about their successes, challenges, and strategies to help you create your plan for financial freedom. Now let's get started.
I love my community. It teaches you the importance of being together even through difficult times. Business owners doing their best to make it through. Fishermen and farmers working hard to put food on our tables. Nurses caring for the sick shows me who we are made of. People who care. I guess it's about growing together.
To ruminate, to create your ultimate living space. And at Courts, you'll find what you need. Choose from our wide range of furniture, electronics, and accessories to complete your space. We're here and ready to assist. Give us a call to place your order. Shop online at shopcourts.com or visit us in store. So ruminate at Courts, bringing value home.
Welcome to episode 22 of the Caribbean Property Investing Podcast. As always, we want to show our appreciation and gratitude by thanking you for supporting the podcast, for sharing the podcast, and for joining the conversation. As we record this episode in July of the year 2021, we can now look back at a year where travel has been pretty much grounded, where the short-term accommodation or just global vacation rental accommodation sector, you know, has been ground to a complete halt. But something interesting is happening. As we speak now in July, we're seeing bumper numbers, very, very high demand for travel, very, very high demand for vacation rental properties, as well as very high demand for sales. And that's a general trend across the Caribbean. I know in the US or in Europe, the phenomenon is now called revenge travel, where people are so keen on getting out after 1 year of lockdown. So this last quarter of 2021, we expect the real estate market across the Caribbean to do very, very, very well. So if you're ever thinking of getting into the game, into getting on the property ladder, now July, August is a very good time because we anticipate by the end of 2021, we expect to see increases in rental prices as well as increases in sale prices when looking to buy property as the snowbirds, persons from Europe and America, come down to the Caribbean to buy properties, whether it's a direct purchase or using one of the citizenship by investment programs. Rest assured, we believe that there is going to be increased demand year on year, and even before the pandemic. So it is with that in mind, we decided to have a friend of the show for us to discuss purchasing property. What are some of the key fundamentals that need to be considered? What you need to know when it comes to purchasing a property, purchasing land, purchasing a building? Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to welcome to the show Thomas Thibbles from Brickstone Law. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Good evening, Anselm. Thank you very much for having me on. I've been certainly looking forward to assisting any way I can with regards to this great initiative that you have been pursuing. And I'm just excited to be here to share and impart any knowledge I have with regards to the acquisition of property in St. Lucia.
Okay, so I first met Thomas officially as a lawyer about five years ago, when one of my properties were being purchased and he represented the buyer. So Thomas, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your law firm?
Thank you, Anselm. Well, as you've introduced me, I'm Thomas Thibbles. I'm an attorney at law in St. Lucia. I'm a partner right now with the firm Brickstone Law. Brickstone Law is a full service practice. While I primarily deal with real estate, banking, corporate and commercial law, our practice boasts a full complement of five attorneys, and we are very much able to assist with all aspects of properties and law and legal services that are required. We also have an affiliation with Brickstone Corporate Services, where we offer financial services dealing with the incorporation of international business companies, as well as an additional company, Blue Marble Citizens, where we offer services along the line of citizenship by investment. This evening, we will be dealing primarily with the property side of the practice. Like Ansem said, we encountered each other professionally about 5 years ago when I dealt with, or I represented a client who was acquiring some property from him. Our friendship actually dates back a bit more than that, to the early 2000s when I was in University of the West Indies and he was with Kevin Wallace at the time. And he came over to the house, and as true St. Lucians and the hospitality across the board, the friendship started from the early 2000s and it stretched until now. It's certainly a pleasure to see that, you know, while we would have gone down different paths with regards to our profession, we somehow were able to come back together and continue to work together and collaborate with regards to initiatives like this. So this evening, I believe Ansem has indicated that he will try his best to steer me down the right path, so I wouldn't be one of those lawyers that ramble for too long. He's indicated to me that his timer is on, so we're going to stick to the boundaries of the show, and if necessary, we can always explore the areas after discussions with some of the viewers.
Before we start about the official subject, why don't you give the audience a little bit about your background?
Well, like I say, I'm an attorney at law. Got admitted to the bar in 2005. I initially practiced in the BVI for a few years. There we did a lot of banking, primarily financial services jurisdiction, so a bit of that. So we then moved back to St. Lucia in approximately 2009. Initially worked with the firm Dubley Anthony & Co. And for a few years did extensive work with regards to property banking and so forth. And then subsequently, my partner, Dwayne Jabatisse, another partner of ours, we formed another partnership. We then transitioned into Brickstone Law about 3.5 years ago, 2018. So we currently located in Rodney Bay, commonly called the Scotiabank Building, but it's formerly the Plaskreel Building where Republic Bank is located. So that's the primary location for our business. But as you know, with law and with services across the board, it's expected that you go to meet the clients. So we are known to work in the full length and breadth of St. Lucia. So from Groseley all the way down to Beaufort, we service our clients accordingly. Some clients require a little bit more time, a little more patience, especially with regards to property transactions, which for the vast majority of clients represents perhaps the most expensive or involved transaction that they would be engaged in. So that's why it's important that we take the clients step by step going through. So it's not unfamiliar, for instance, for the practice to require 7 days a week engaging with the clients and answering different questions and so forth. What I will say is that the experience of working with different clients, different officials from the government and so forth, has assisted in terms of being able to give the guidance necessary with regards to the process and make it as smooth process as possible. By all means, there's always room for improvement, always room for new lessons to be learned and so forth. So I don't profess to have full expertise. Every day I learn something new. Learned something new this morning when I spoke to the legal officer at the CIP unit, for instance. It was very helpful on matters. So it's practice. It's called a practice in laws because you continue to learn, to evolve, and to get better with time. So, but ultimately, like I said, we want to stay on topic with regards to that. So, Ansem.
So Thomas, we are very, very strong advocates for acquiring your own property, everybody. But we believe that the first step in getting on the property ladder is to convert your rent to a mortgage. And invariably, in most cases, a common way a very common way to do that is to purchase a piece of land and then you build on it. That's what I think most Caribbean young people, professionals, young people were actually advised to by our parents. Okay, Thomas, so I've seen a piece of land that I like. I watched a podcast, so I obviously looked at facilities nearby, whether it's a supermarket, a school, a bus stop, transportation, other recreational amenities. I'm hell-bent. That's the property I want. I have the money approved by the bank, and somebody told me, okay, you know what? You need to go to get a lawyer for yourself to start the process. I come to you. What do we do?
Well, coming to me, I would perhaps say is probably the most important thing you would want to do or you should need to do in relation to it. Because coming to see a lawyer with regards to a property transaction is it's a critical, essential part of the process. Ultimately, the lawyer will guide it through and the process of the conveyance of the title would be done through the attorney. But using use example, Anselm, you've indicated that you've identified the parcel of land that has caught your eye, you have steady income, and you've met all the criteria of the bank, so we'll skip over the financial capacity part. We're looking at what next. So you've come to me, you've indicated I'm going to be purchasing some property from John Brown. Presumably, John Brown would have given you some indication as to the block and parcel number. So just put a bulletin right there. In St. Lucia, we have a system of law which is governed by the Land Registration Act, so that all property in St. Lucia is identifiable by block and parcels. Property can either be in the Crown or in private. Crown basically is a government or a governmental agency like Invest St. Lucia, etc. Private presumably would be, as stated, in the hands of a private entity, an individual, which is a natural person, or through a company. But more importantly, all properties in St. Lucia is divided into or identifiable by block and parcel. That means in the scenario we're putting forth, Anselm, you are purchasing from John Brown, let's say the properties in Groseley. So we will say properties identifiable by block 145B, 1454B, parcel number one. The first thing as an attorney, what I would do, I would proceed to have my clerk conduct a search at the Registry of Lands and a search at the Survey Department. The purpose of that search is to obtain what is called a land register. The land register under our law would perhaps be the most important document because under the Land Registration Act, the land register determines or identifies all ownership, which is the registered proprietor, and any encumbrances, which would be, for instance, any mortgages, etc. It would also indicate whether there's a survey plan involved. It will also give an approximation of the acreage of the property. And it will also indicate whether there are any interests of any third parties by a quotient. But let's presume on the basis that John Brown is selling to you, and just to make it easy, John Brown may, for instance, have a mortgage existing with the Bank of St. Lucia. The search would reveal that John Brown is the owner. So what we would obtain first is a land register. We would also obtain what is called a title deed, which would indicate or will be the instrument by which John Brown acquired title to the property. We may also get a copy of the mortgage that he had undertaken, which commonly called a mortgage, but under our law is properly called a hypothecary obligation. A bit of a mouthful, but we call it the hypothec. So my clerk would obtain all of these necessary documents in addition to the survey plan and the map sheet. So I've obtained all of these documents for you, Anselm, and now we're meeting together. I will show you the land register and I would indicate to you that it shows that title is properly in the name of John Brown. The land register also show that there's a mortgage in favor of the Bank of St. Lucia or hypothec in favor of the Bank of St. Lucia. So it shows that there is approximately, let's say, 10,000 square feet of land. So the survey plan will confirm that. The map sheet will show the neighboring parcels. Our John Brown's parcel number one, so next door may be number two, and south of it may be number three, etc. So we now have all the necessary documents with regards to the establishing of title, verification with regards to the size of the property, and also notice of any interest from a third party, in this case, for instance, the Bank of St. Lucia, in relation to that. So the question will be, therefore, what next? We always advise our clients to, in the event that they are to sell property or acquire property, should say, that they do enter into an agreement for sale with the vendor. Purpose of the agreement for sale would be to establish the rights and obligations of the parties going forward. Customary in St. Lucia, the deposit would be approximately 10%. There are certain consequences which we can perhaps explore a little later with regards to that. But let's just say from the perspective of it that the interest, the property is going to be acquired for $100,000. The expectation is that you put a 10% deposit down. But before we get to the agreement for sale part of it, I would then have to advise John Brown as to what necessary documents that he would need to supply with regards to me. The documents that he would be looking at, of course, would be to establish, one, identity. So you will need to provide a copy of his identification. And then we will look at John Brown, for instance, is maybe a common name in St. Lucia. As such, we may need to have confirmation as to his address, his residential address, postal address, as well as his marital status, and as well as the occupation in relation to these things. So, Anselm, you've sat before me, and this is all we've got. Gotten all the necessary documents in relation to this, and the process thereafter will guide you through.
I have a question. A couple of things. Well, one, the agreement for sale. Who typically does that? Is it initiated by the seller or the buyer, or it doesn't really matter? And two, what happens when you have multiple owners on the land register for one piece of land?
Okay. So there is no hard and fast rule with regards to the preparation of the agreement for sale. What I would, ordinarily, the purchaser would take responsibility, or their attorney would take responsibility for the preparation of the agreement for sale, on the basis that that party would be the one that their rights have to be secured. And remember, the purchaser is going to be required to put a deposit down, and therefore, all rights and obligations flowing from that agreement should properly be done or overseen by their attorney. However, there's no hard and fast rule, so it may be possible that the vendor's attorney would prepare this. Of course, that agreement would have to be reviewed by the purchaser's attorney before there is execution and payment of the deposit, etc. So that's in the first question. With regard to the second question, it is not unusual that property in St. Lucia has more than one owner or more than one individual registered as more than one registered proprietor. So in a case where there may be one, two, three, four, there can be a maximum of four. Anything more would open up trustees for sale, but that's a separate issue. So let's say three owners. There might be a situation where someone passed away and they passed the property on to their three children. They all live overseas, which is a very common thing, and they decided that they're not returning to St. Lucia, they want to sell. The process is no different. Basically, the necessary information has to be obtained for all the registered proprietors to get that process going forward. So it's no different than it's one or three or four individuals. The ownership or the shares with regards to the property would be identified on the land register, because it's quite possible that while there may be multiple owners, it's possible that three individuals, one individual has a half share and the other two individuals have quarter shares to make the whole with regards to that.
So now we have identified who the owners are, we've checked it, we've confirmed all of the encumbrances or all of the liens or property. We've confirmed through your clerk and through your work that it's free and clear, and this person who is selling the land has the right to sell the property. What happens next?
Well, that's very important, because many times you would have situations where individuals will state that property is being sold, and they may state that it's their land and therefore they have the capacity or the legal capacity to sell the property. The importance of the search is highlighted then, because if John Brown indicates to you that he owns the property, when I obtain the land register, it should properly state John Brown. Now, what commonly happens is people act on behalf of individuals in an informal capacity and in a more formal capacity by virtue of power of attorney, etc. Once we've identified or confirmed that the individual in fact has proper title, that means they have the capacity to convey the property that way. So we move past the situation, or move past the point of the execution of the agreement for sale. Must state that agreements for sale are fairly serious documents, and I would strongly urge individuals to seek legal counsel or advice before they engage or enter into any agreement for sale. It is customary in our law that in the event that parties enter into agreement for sale, there will be a 90-day window for the completion. There may be provision for extension in the event of any issues arising and so forth, but ordinarily 90 days would be the window for closing. Now, this is important. In the event that within the 90 days, the vendor is unable to complete the transaction for whatever reason, can't get clean title, etc., they will be required to return the deposit and an amount equivalent to that amount to the purchaser. In the event the purchaser is unable to proceed, the vendor would be entitled to forfeit the deposit and not proceed with the transaction. Because of the relatively onerous and punitive results arising from agreements for sale, I strongly urge individuals not to draft agreements for sale for themselves, but to rely on attorneys, and not to proceed for these into these agreements for sale unless there have has been proper searches have been undertaken. For instance, within our firm, what we would go a bit beyond just looking at the question of title, we would undertake a search at the registry of the Supreme Court or registry of the High Court, at the registry of deeds and mortgages to determine whether there are any judgments against the individuals. For instance, John Brown may have a judgment against him, which was not recorded on the land register. But under our law, once a judgment exists, it automatically attaches to all the property as well. So the importance of going to an attorney is to ensure that title is very much in order. While the registered land system allows for a very clear and easy path with regards to identification as to whether or not property is actually who owns something in a simple sense, there are certain aspects within it that may be on the knowledge and awareness of the layperson. So within our office, what we want to do is to make sure before that agreement for sale is signed, that there are no third-party claims. If John Brown is, for instance, he's married and so forth, that there is a clear understanding with regards to his spouse in terms of any interest she may have in relation to the property and so forth. But ultimately, these are matters that the attorney would be in a position to advise the purchaser, in this case, you, on. So operating or proceeding on the basis that the property has no encumbrances, meaning no mortgages, there are no third party put a caution on it, meaning that he was planning to sell to somebody else. There is a single owner. John Brown has, of course, provided all his necessary documents. Then we can proceed with regards to the execution of the agreement. And of course, one of the documents that the banks may require would be either the agreement for sale or the a vendor's letter.
Let's take a pin here. I think it's important for us to speak to the instance where you have a portion of the deposit that's non-refundable. Typically, it's a 90-day holding period, but I've lost money already. I saw a piece of property, amazing sea view. I like sea view, properties. And to secure it, the vendor had an agreement for sale. I signed it. I didn't go to a lawyer. It's very early in the game, obviously. And yes. During that the 90-day period, when I was doing my due diligence, I discovered that there was a stream running through the property, and it was dry season, so you would see very little sand. When you walk down the property, you're actually walking on the riverbed. And I was like, what? That's the middle of the property. So I then tried to have a discussion with the vendor. I said, well, you know, I got the land documents, a topography map, and when I walked it, with my architect, we saw that it's a dry riverbed. You know, I no longer want the property, and I did not get my money back. So it was a lesson learned. After that, obviously, I always went to a lawyer. But I think it's important for our audience to understand there is that clause, a non-refundable portion of that deposit.
Anselm, that's a very good question you pose. The non-refundable aspect of the agreement is something that is intended to protect both parties. The scenario you presented is that you basically walk the property afterwards and identified a flaw that may change your mind. You say a dry ravine or perhaps a noisy neighbor or so forth. Once it doesn't go to the title of the property or aspects with regards to title, then it ordinarily doesn't trigger your ability to demand the return of your deposit. What I also would encourage you to do, a lot of people don't, is walk the land, bring a friend, preferably someone like you, Anselm, who's very familiar with land, property, and so forth, and most importantly, get a surveyor. The simple task of verifying the boundary markers and so forth is something that will help save you a lot of grief and expenses down the line. So walk the land. I know you've pointed it out. A lot of times, sometimes people acquire property that the brush has not been cleared. So you're not quite sure as to where the boundary ends. Sometimes they buy property and there are no boundary markers down, and it can lead to a potential future dispute with a neighbor with regards to that. Also, you visit the land at different times. During a very rainy day, maybe a good time to visit the property as well, get a good sense as to the drainage and any issues with regards to flooding. Have a chat with some of the neighbors and so forth, because they know the property, they've been around, they can probably indicate to you why this dream piece of land has been sitting there vacant for so long. No, it's not a blessing from God. It's because there is an issue with regards to it collects water, or there's some other issue there. But what more importantly, from a legal perspective, while I encourage clients to do so, unless there is an issue with regards to the title, meaning that there is a situation which would affect the ability to convey title between party A and party B, the ability to get a refund for your deposit is compromised, therefore. So what you want to do, and perhaps the lesson I want to emphasize, is to cover all bases as much as possible. It's a very expensive undertaking in acquiring property, so you shouldn't really necessarily try to cut on costs by not getting all of these things done. Rely on friends, family, and so forth. A lot of people have experience with regards to these things, and you can lean on that experience. For instance, wouldn't buy property without running it by Anselm, because he's, as he says, he's gone down the road and he's dealt with the difficulties of property and so forth. But leading on to the question of the refund of the deposit, it's really primarily a question of law as to whether or not the title can be conveyed. Now, Anselm, you could have bought the property, but the ravine or the dry ravine in there made you change your mind, or the stream and so forth. But remember, John Brown could sell it to you and it's very much still good property. What you want to do with it may be compromised as a result of it. I always say, you know, you take no chances with regards to it. There's nothing, life is free, only salvation of God. So you need to make sure you cover all your bases when you go with that.
Okay, property agreement, sale agreement for sale in hand. What's the next step for the purchaser?
Okay, ordinarily, I would say 99% of transactions, the acquisition of property are done through financing through financial institutions, meaning that your bank or the credit union would probably be the financing agent with regards to the acquisition of the property. Now, the fact that there is a financing agent or financial institution involved, or a bank, would mean, therefore, that there would be another party who would have an interest in ensuring that proper title has actually been conveyed. So you have your agreement for sale in hand, you have necessary particulars on John Brown, his ID, occupation, residential address, etc. It will be important to get from him, in addition, some clearances. Now, these clearances are commonly called compliance certificates and so forth, are primarily from three institutions. One from the National Insurance Corporation. John Brown might be an employer, or maybe a delinquent employer who may be owing NIC dues. But you would want to get a letter from him from NIC confirming that John Brown owes NIC nothing. And then there are two documents from the Inland Revenue Department. One from the Property Tax Department confirming that there are no property taxes owing on that property you're acquiring. And from the income tax side of things, where you would want to get a copy of a compliance certificate confirming that John Brown owes no income taxes. Now, the relevance of these compliance certificates is, under our law, any debts to the government through taxes or through the NIC are considered what are called privileged debts. So they rank above all other charges. So registered or not, meaning that whether or not they're on the land register, they still rank above. So before the conveyance of any property, you would want to make sure that there are no interests or no claims or no privileged debts against the property. So John Brown is going to have to provide you with clearance certificates. The other factor is that you, as the prospective purchaser, are going to have to get these same documents yourself, because the bank or the credit union is not going to lend you any money if you owe the Inland Revenue Department or the NIC. Because remember, these debts rank above the bank. And after they've lent you the money, the priority payment must still go through these institutions. So we're proceeding on the basis that there are no debts. All John Brown's certificates are pretty much clean and clear. So we're then looking at the next stage. So the attorney would then prepare two legal instruments. One would be the deed of transfer, which would actually be the instrument which conveys title. And the other would be the hypothecary obligation. The hypothecary obligation is the instrument which actually places a charge on the property, or commonly called a mortgage. But before the bank would be willing to extend that sum to you, they would need their attorney to look at it. So this is a process of vetting or visaing, as they should say. So your attorney, Anselm, would prepare the bundle of documents, copies of IDs of both parties, all the necessary information, all the compliance certificates, draft of the deed, and a draft of the mortgage, and forward to the respective bank's attorneys for them to look at it. Once they have signed off that everything is in order, they would then provide notification to the bank that they may proceed. What happens at this stage right now shows the importance of the attorney. Not only is the attorney the party in which prepares the documents facilitating the transfer, the attorney would also be the party receiving the funds from the respective bank. Now, before the bank would be extending any funds to an attorney who is not technically bound to pay, they would want the attorney to somehow show some commitment to foresee the transaction through. This is where the attorney would prepare what is called a letter of undertaking. So in a situation like yours, Anselm, you're borrowing to purchase from John Brown. You come to see me at Brickstone Law. We prepared all the necessary documents, and we have now, the bank has gotten the confirmation from their attorneys that we may proceed. I would then be required to issue the letter of undertaking to the bank. So let's say the Bank of St. Lucia, in relation to this, would be issued a letter of undertaking from me. Bank of St. Lucia would then proceed to give me $90,000. Because remember, the land is being bought for $100,000 and you put $10,000. I would then present to the bank a letter of undertaking telling the bank that if I am unable to register for any reason, I will return the funds to them. But we expect the transaction to go through. So the attorney has the money to close. You are the anxious purchaser, because this is now crunch time. You the night before, you can feel it in your bones, in your chest. You can see, okay, we're going to sign the closing tomorrow. So we proceed to our office. We sit together. The purchaser would come have a look at the documents and be presented with the check. Now, in St. Lucia, there are taxes involved with regards to the conveyance of property. The purchaser has to pay what is called a stamp duty, and the vendor pays a vendor's tax in relation to it. So I will go into on with regards to some of the expenses in relation to it, because that's an important part of it. But essentially at the closing, the vendor would ordinarily get the net proceeds of sale, which would be the amount less the vendor's tax, which works on a scale but can be approximately 4.5% with regards to that. And they then execute the deed, and the attorney would then proceed to present that said deed to the Inland Revenue Department for the payment of stamp duty. Once that has been assessed and properly stamped, proceed to the land registry for registration of the said deed. What you would find is within a four to six week window is that the land register would then be presented. The same land register which you said John Brown would reflect now Anselm Mathre, Esquire.
So the land register will now show my name or the purchaser name, as well as the financial institution, if there's a mortgage on it, right, Thomas?
So this actually goes in process. It goes in stages, because in order for you as the purchaser to pledge a property or place a charge on the property, you must first get title. So the first document that the attorney would register would be the deed of transfer, which transfers title from John Brown to yourself. Then the second document we would have to register would be the hypothecary obligation, which would be noted in the encumbrances section on the back. So it may say, for instance, charge in favor or hypothecary obligation in favor of the Bank of St. Lucia in the sum of $90,000 with interest at the rate of, well, your favorite customer, so let's say 4.75%. And then that land register would then be. Now, two things. The lawyer would have to, one, of course, present the registered hypothecary obligation to the bank, and, of course, to you as a purchaser, the registered deed of sale or deed of transfer and the land register duly showing the necessary changes in relation to this. I want to touch a little bit with regards to the related costs in there. I think it's important because what happens invariably is clients would be looking primarily at the cost of the land in terms of the, as opposed to the cost of the transaction in relation to acquiring property. So what I would have touched on before is there are taxes, of course, there are legal fees with regards to that, and there are search fees. The legal fees and search fees are really governed by, on the legal fee side, by the Bar Association tariff. So there is supposed to be some uniformity, some certainty with regards to the fees that attorneys are supposed to charge a client. It really depends upon the value of the transaction as opposed to the nature of what is being done. So it in this case there, you are proceeding on a acquisition of property for $100,000. The legal fees would be based upon that figure. The taxes as well, which would be stamp duty. Stamp duty would be the tax that the purchaser would be paying. Stamp duty would be approximately 2% of the stated amount. So as the in the scenario with regards to the acquisition of property, you would be expected to pay 2% of the $100,000 to the government of St. Lucia. Now remember, you're also taking a mortgage as well. There are stamp duties in relation to the mortgage as well, considerably lower than the amounts for the acquisition of property at 0.25%, but nevertheless, still also a factor in the cost. What I would indicate to clients with regards to that is when they are indicating interest in the acquisition of property, the first meeting with the lawyers may properly be with regards to what the approximate cost would be, because the cost of the transaction can be factored into the loan, but it can also come from savings. Now, if you are saying I'm buying a piece of land for $100,000, which most people would say I'm buying some land, then they say, well, I know I have to put on 10%, so I have to put $10,000 down, and the bank is going to give me the rest. What you rarely find, though, is that you may have to also find an additional, let's say, 3 to 5% on top of that to meet legal fees, taxes, as well as search fees and so forth. We also encourage clients that when they have executed agreements for sale, that they prepare what they call, or the attorney prepares what is called a caution. Caution is just, in a simple sense, a legal instrument which restricts the ability of the vendor to conduct any transactions on the property until a defined event. A defined event, for instance, can be the actual sale of the property or a certain amount of time has passed. So what I want to leave with regards to that is the emphasis that it's important to speak to an attorney and have them guide you through all processes and all stages of the process. Cost is a factor in relation to this, because ultimately you wouldn't want to go so far as to negotiate and only to realize that you are the obstacle that you, of course, that you may need to get some more savings in there before you can proceed in relation to that. You certainly want the attorney to make sure he's covered all his bases with regards to doing all the necessary searches and so forth. So you want to make sure that the attorney is involved in every process and not come to the attorney at the point when, for instance, you've signed an agreement for sale, paid a deposit, and John Brown, who you thought owned the land, was actually acting on behalf of his sister who lives in New York, and he has no power of attorney to act, and they might not even be on speaking terms. So you and the property itself has a mortgage in relation to it. You want to avoid these scenarios. So what I probably want to emphasize is that it's very important to have the attorney be involved in every stage of the transaction and to avoid a scenario where you are an attorney is only contacted or retained after the agreement for sale has been executed, before any searches can be conducted, and of course, before any other experts, for instance, surveyors and so on, could have been retained to verify information, which would be very important with regards to that. The attorney will also give an indication on cost. Now, I believe Ansem had some questions with regards, or may want to explore the issue of cost. While the stamp duty is fixed, 2% when you're purchasing land and 0.25% of whatever you're going to be borrowing from the financial institution, the legal fees would be actually be based upon a tariff set by the Bar Association. It's actually upon a sliding scale. So for instance, you know, the first, they'll be banned. So the first 50,000, the next 25,000, the next 50,000 after that, and so forth. So it's percentages of each band that we're looking at. So it would be a situation where the attorney would have to calculate what the consideration of what you'd be buying the property from, and then give you an indication of it thereafter.
For me, I use a guide of roughly 15% for all my fees, all my taxes, all my fees, about 15%. Yes. And as always, I try to negotiate with everyone along the way. And my final question, Thomas, God forbid, during the process, the final stage of the process, where perhaps the before we get title passed on to us, or the purchaser, God forbid the vendor passes away. What happens next? And what's the quickest way for us to get that transaction back on track and not jeopardize it altogether?
Are you referring to before the vendors executed the deed of sale, or
yes,
or after?
Before the deed of sale is executed.
Okay, so the agreement for sale between the parties would also bind the estate and the successors of the vendor. So what I refer to is the case of John Brown, using the Black example. So you've executed agreements for sale with John Brown. You have 90 days, so we've executed it early January, and you're supposed to have January, February, and March to be able to complete the transaction. Unfortunately, disaster has fallen John Brown and he passed away in February. The law allows you to be protected still, because remember, you have an agreement for sale with John Brown and his estate is still liable to transfer to you. What you would have to do in a simple sense is, or John Brown's executor, or if he has a will, or his administrator, if he doesn't have a will, would have to then apply for to the court for either probate or letter of administration to be in a position to convey title to you. That would perhaps extend the time within which you can the transaction can close. But until we have someone with the legal capacity to sign on behalf of John Brown, you would not be able to get title to the property. But while the agreement for sale is in place and while you have a caution, you will be protected at that point in time, meaning that nothing can happen, or no, the property can be conveyed to a third party without your knowledge or your permission and so forth. It is not unusual for something like that to happen. Life is such a way that it can go this way. But there are ways in which that the attorney can protect you to make sure that while the John Brown's family undertakes the necessary legal steps or avenues with regards to having a personal legal representative for him, that you are protected in that time.
Wow. Thank you, Thomas, for such insight. And I like the thorough step-by-step explanation. So for our audience listening and viewing, how can they get in touch with you or Brickstone?
Thank you, Anton. Brickstone Law, we're located in the Plasterfield Building, commonly called Scotiabank or Republic Bank Building in Rodney Bay. We can be, our contact information is 450-3000, or you can reach us on info@BrickstoneLaw, that's BrickstoneLaw.com, or myself, Thomas@BrickstoneLaw.com. We'd be happy to serve you or provide you guidance with regards to any transactions that you would be pursuing.
Okay, awesome. Don't forget to add that +758 before that number, just in case you call an outside of St. Lucia.
Indeed.
So you've been listening to another episode of the Caribbean Property Investing Podcast. We had on today Thomas Thiebles from Brickstone Law, where we went through the actual process and some of the pitfalls and challenges and what you need to know when purchasing a piece of property. We didn't get to purchasing a building, but we will have that on a subsequent podcast. I will tell you though, when I went to move ahead without getting the services of a lawyer, I paid about $4,000 for me trying to cut corners and save money. So in the end, it ended up being more expensive. The searches and the work that the legal practitioners conduct is invaluable and perhaps, you know, unsurpassed. I strongly recommend that you do so even before actually identifying the plot of land. So remember, you can check us out on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Caribbean Property Investing Podcast, or our website, CaribbeanPropertyInvestingPodcast.com. And as I always say, everyone needs a place to live. Own yours. Until next time.
I love my community. It teaches you the importance of being together even for difficult times. Business owners doing their best to make it through. Fishermen and farmers working hard to put food on our tables. Nurses caring for the sick shows me who we are made of. People who care. I guess it's about growing together.
To ruminate, to create your ultimate living space. And at Courts, you'll find what you need. Choose from our wide range of furniture, electronics, and accessories to complete your space. We're here and ready to assist. Give us a call to place your order. Shop online at shopcourts.com or visit us in store. So ruminate at Courts, bringing value home.
Congratulations and thank you for tuning in to the Caribbean's first property investing podcast. We want to help Caribbean people create wealth and achieve financial freedom through property investing. Our show provides general advice based on personal experiences and is for educational purposes only. For more information, resources, and past episodes, visit us at CaribbeanPropertyInvesting.com. Remember to click the subscribe button so you never miss a show. Let's go.